are you talking about?
Check your gear.
Running diagnostics now, Captain.
Sonar is working, Captain. The Russian disappeared. 1 minute he was steady, 4,000 yards off the bow, and then he was gone. And for a second, I thought I heard...
Heard what?
I thought I heard singing, sir.
Singing?
Yes, sir.
Greetings, Submariners, and welcome to another episode of the Next Land Podcast here on, I almost said here on giantbomb.com because I'm so used to at being the thing I say at the end of a podcast that I'm introducing. I'm going to have to get used to that. Here on Nextlander, where we talk about movies and television, things that we are watching. And this week and this month, our movies have been determined by you, the viewer. We put some things up on a poll. We said, hey, do you want us to watch some James Caan movies or maybe some werewolf movies or what have you? And you chose the submarine genre. A few films, including one that we've watched today, that we're going to be talking about today, that Brad Shoemaker had been champing at the bit to watch.
Look, it's a long list of movies that I've never seen, but this one was up there. Like, this is of everything we've watched so far, this was the one where I sat down and the most said, I can't believe I'm about to watch this. I can't believe in 2 hours I will have seen The Hunt for Red October. Holy shit.
I am super excited to hear what you have to say after all these years of build-up. Vinny Caravella, also joining us as always. You've seen this movie before.
I have. Thank you, Alex. Yes, I have. I saw this probably around the time it came out. So my muddled up memory of it is now precise and clear, and coming to it with a 40 plus year old's perspective is a very different movie than when I saw it, which was probably preteen, and it was a weird, I thought it was a cool submarine action movie and maybe didn't put together all the other stuff going on inside of it.
Well, for all the other stuff going on inside of it, we decided that we needed a submarine expert to join us here on the podcast. So joining us for this episode, and I don't know, are you joining us for the other submarine movies we're doing as well? Drew Scanlon, hi.
Hello. Yes, it's me, the sub driver. I know everything about submarines. Ask me anything about submarines. Okay. I would love to. I love sub movies. I am not a dad, but basically that.
I feel like dad cinema is dad, definitely within your wheelhouse.
Dad like in your tendencies. I get it. I understand.
Absolutely. So this is right in my sub wheel house.
So Drew, you refresh my memory. I know you did a film in 40s when we were back at Giant Bomb for this film. Was that the first time you had seen it?
No.
Okay.
This is one of those movies that's like been around my entire life. Like there was a VHS tape and then there was a DVD.
Okay.
And there is now a Blu-ray, and it's just, I don't remember the first time I saw it. I've always known.
Marco Ramius has always been there with you as like a guiding light in your life.
That's right.
I would agree. That's kind of how my perception of that movie is as well. Like, I don't think I saw it in theaters. Like 1990, I was just like a little too young to be like, yeah, I want to go see this movie about submarines. But around the time it was available on VHS and you could rent it at Blockbuster, I saw it pretty quickly after that, and I loved it to the point where I did go see Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger in theaters when those movies came out. And yes, I have owned numerous permutations of that film on home video. It is a great film, and I think arguably probably still the best Tom Clancy adaptation.
Yeah, I agree. I'm glad to hear that you are also familiar with the Clanceverse.
Oh yeah, okay. I don't know about you guys. I somehow, the first like adult novelist I ended up reading books by was Tom Clancy. And
oh,
I could not tell you why this was exactly. My grandfather did read a bunch of his books because he was ex-military and he was into that kind of stuff. But it wasn't him that made me do it. I think it was literally other kids in my class were starting to read more adult literature stuff. And I was just like, I need some books. I need to start reading some cool books. I need to start reading some adult books. What do I get? And then I found a copy of The Hunt for Red October cheap at like a, you know, whatever a bookseller was back then, and read it. And I understood maybe 25% of it, but that 25% I loved.
Yeah, and I think that's kind of why Clancy is so popular, is because, or the same reason that he would be, that a kid would be drawn to a Clancy book is kind of the reason that he kind of took off, is because they seem very adult in like the, in that they have so many details.
Yes.
And like concrete real stuff in them that I think as a kid reading that, you'd be like, oh man, I know how the world works and everything.
Totally.
One particular view of the world. Yes.
Yes.
Man, look at the CIA. True. You don't even know what the CIA is out there doing. I know.
I mean, this was my first like direct exposure to any Jack Ryan anything, but I've been like aware of Jack Ryan since like, I mean, like Patriot Games, if nothing else, like the Harrison Ford stuff. This sent me down a little bit of a rabbit hole of realizing how many Jack Ryans there have been.
Uh-huh. There have been four or five.
It's
five.
So it's,
because
it's
if
Alec
you count
Baldwin.
The TV one, the one, the Amazon series. Yes, that's five.
Is that five?
Was that the guy from The Office?
That's the guy from The Office.
Yeah, Krasinski. Okay. Yeah, John Krasinski. Like Ben Affleck, Chris Pine, Harrison Ford, and Alec Baldwin. I guess that's all of them. Anyway, it really made me realize how much Jack Ryan is really just kind of like right-wing, jingoistic James Bond, right? Like, is that,
I mean,
kind of...
Not like hard right,
well,
but
no,
like
no.
Very
I'm,
90s
I'm,
like yeah. business Republican right.
Yes, yes, that's what I mean. I'm really talking more about who Tom Clancy was than who Jack yes. Ryan is here.
I was more of a like a John Grisham kid. That was
I moved on to Grisham and and to Michael Crichton not too long after.
Yeah,
that.
I was a Crichton guy.
Okay.
Yes, Jurassic Park was an early thick novel.
So we had all our bases covered. You had your military, you had your law, and you had mm-hmm. your science, and we knew everything about it. We had basically
totally.
Covered
you
all.
You throw
the
some Clive Cussler right. in there, and you hit the four way on airport novels.
Yeah, I hadn't actually read The Hunt for Red October until about a year ago.
Okay, how did you find it? Because what I remember about that book, and I went on to read some of the other Clancy novels. It is the least leaden with like technical babble, but also still has a lot of it. After that, he just went apeshit with that stuff. Like three quarters of all those other novels are literally just him describing missile systems.
Yeah, I remember reading Without Remorse, and there's like a whole chapter about him just building a gun with like a drill press, and like he's crafting a gun himself. Anyway, so let's just say that reading the book gave me an immense respect for this movie's script.
Yes.
Because the movie is just so efficient. Because, Tom Clancy, even though this is more of his hallmark in later books, he does marinate a lot in the details.
Yes.
And it's also just a little more, and I guess, it was written in 1984 by Tom Clancy. And so it's not as nuanced maybe in perspective. Like whenever the book goes to like the Russian perspective, it's all just very like, it hammers home the deficiencies of the Soviet system. And, while there are a lot of it, even reading it now, it's just like, okay, I get it. Like, okay, this is not as good as America.
That's kind of,
like,
yes,
I understand.
That's very much what I meant about Tom Clancy. Just kind of constant West is the best sort of
propaganda. I mean, maybe I'm misremembering, but the thing I remember about it is that he's not ungenerous to the Soviets. Like, he has respect for the people that are, like, the commanders. Like, he thinks Ramius is a really interesting person, but, like, at the same time, it's more about the system. Like, the idea that, like, because the soldiers were conscripts, they just weren't as talented as the volunteer American sailors. And, it's not so much that, like, the people on the boats were the problem. It was that the political system had left them in a state where they were always going to be inferior to the United States system.
Yeah. By the way, the paperback that I have is blurbed by Reagan.
Oh, well, there you go.
Enough said.
There
Who
it
calls
is.
It the perfect yarn.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
This is some Cold War ass.
Oh, for
cold,
sure.
I mean,
it's the quintessential.
So, yeah.
Two things. So I watched some of the kind of interviews with cast and director, et cetera, on the Blu-ray after I finished the movie. First of all, there is absolutely a part where I think it's McTiernan or somebody is like, Like, yeah, man, Clancy would spend three pages describing a military issue pencil. Like, it was just. But the other thing I got the impression about is that, like, is how close is the book to the movie? Because he kind of made it sound like they did treatment based on the book and then just kind of scrapped it and wrote something super different, was kind of what it sounded like.
It's not so different. It's certainly slimmer and I think smaller in scope. I think Clancy tried to make, there's a lot more of like buildup of international forces and this might spark a war. And so you're jumping around between a lot of different perspectives. Jack Ryan goes to like a British ship for a while. There's another sub that has a reactor meltdown that's trying to chase down the Red October. And so it's a lot more, you know, large. There are minor, I think, differences in like the way that characters are treated. I think Sam Neill's character is not as big a thing. I think
he also Skarsgård's
character. Oh, okay. I think Skarsgård's character is also a little more, actually kind of the reverse of what I was saying. He's a little more nuanced. He's not like the, we gotta kill Ramius. He's more like, I guess I gotta follow my orders, but I kind of don't want to kill another Russian. So it's not beat by beat, but it's also not a complete rewrite, I think.
Yeah. Well, before we get into the meat of the movie here, just a few, historical things, just to kind of give some background on this. So as we said, yes, this is Clancy's first novel. He had been working as an insurance agent in the early 80s. I had always misremembered him as having some kind of desk job in military, whether it was CIA or something else, but apparently that was just what he wanted.
I'm sure that's what he wanted you to think.
Yeah. Well, so the thing is, he was actually rejected from military service because he had terrible eyesight, and so he just could not join any kind of branch of the military. And I think the other misconception was just because those things were so, his novels were so detailed, everyone just assumed, oh, well, he just knew stuff. But no, he just read technical manuals and books about subs and you know, variety of other military literature, to the point where, like, when he sold the book to the Naval Institute Press, who put out the first version of it, they even told him, you need to take about 100 pages of, like, technical shit out of this book because it's too much. And he ended up selling it for about $5,000, and then obviously went on to become a huge bestseller.
And that was mid-80s when that was written?
Yeah, 85, I think, is when it was published.
I looked these up because I was curious. So 85 also, I think, is the year Rocky IV came out, where Rocky fights Ivan Drago. Also the year that White Knights came out, the movie with Gregory Hines. So just to put in perspective what was going on with the Soviet Union at that time, everything was going on with the Soviet Union at that time.
Yeah, the Reagan era of the Cold War was definitely the most media-focused, feel like, in terms of the movies we were watching.
Gosh, like, when did Red Dawn come out? That's probably
83 or 4, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah, 84. Like, everything is going on at this time.
Yeah. So the book was optioned in 85. They spent a year and a half trying to get a studio involved, but everyone thought it was not going to work as a movie until Paramount finally signed on. The screenplay was written by Larry Ferguson, who wrote Highlander, Beverly Hills Cop 2, and was one of the writers on Alien 3. And then also by Donald Ferguson, who at this point had only really written a movie called Missing in 1982, but then he went on to write the scripts for Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger. Mm. And also John Milius did some uncredited writing on this, bringing it back from the Jaws episode. He wrote most of Ramius's speeches in this movie, as well as a bunch of his Russian dialogue.
Okay.
As we mentioned before, this is John McTiernan, who had maybe one of the single best, I'm going to call it 10-year spans for a director before completely falling off the face of the map. This is the man who directed Die Hard. This is the man who directed Predator. Last Action Hero, the Thomas Crown Affair remake. Also the most famous figure implicated in the Anthony Pelicano wiretapping scandal, which sent him to prison for a couple of years.
That is quite a story.
Yeah, that's a whole other thing. But John McTiernan, I think, like, between Die Hard and, let's say, this, that's about as good a few years as you're going to ever have as a director. There was some trepidation from the Navy about working on this movie because they weren't unsure. They thought they were going to give away, like, classified stuff. But they were eventually brought, like, several admirals in the Navy at the time really liked the book, and they thought this movie would do for submarine sailors what Top Gun did for fighter pilots.
Okay.
My understanding is the Pentagon loves working with films of this nature and helping them in any way they can for exactly that reason.
Yes, it depends on the film, because when we do Crimson Tide later this month, you will find out that they were a little less apt for that one, and you'll probably figure out why pretty quick. They had access to several Los Angeles-class submarines in real life, mostly just for the sake of photographing so they could build the sets. They kept them out of the classified areas, obviously. But Alec Baldwin and Scott Glenn got to go tool around on the USS Salt Lake City for a little bit to learn how to drive the boat. Several of these actors were in the military. Scott Glenn was in the Marine Corps. Sean Connery served in the Royal Navy. James Earl Jones was in the Army. The original choice for Jack Ryan was Kevin Costner.
Of course, he's the original choice for anything from 1980 to 1995.
Yeah, that was mentioned. McTiernan mentioned that in the interviews and was just like, he said the response was just like, he was busy with that Buffalo movie.
Yes.
is how it was described.
He was like neck deep in getting ready to make Dances with Wolves, so he turned it down. They did also approach Harrison Ford at one point about it. Obviously, he would go on to become, I'm going to say, the best Jack Ryan, even though I think Hunt for Red October is the best Jack Ryan movie. Originally, Ramius was going to be played by an Austrian actor named Klaus Maria Brandauer, whose most famous role was in the movie Out of Africa. He was nominated for Academy Award for that movie. But he had to duck out after 2 weeks of production because of some kind of conflict, so they faxed the script to Connery. And he said he wouldn't do it because it was too unbelievable, because he didn't believe that the Soviet Navy at that point could believably do the things that were described in the script, but they forgot to send him the first page of the script that explained that the movie takes place in 1984 when this would have been more believable. So that was how they eventually, he's like, oh, no, we forgot to send you a page.
Oh, right, because the wall came down in 89,
yeah,
and that's right when the movie was probably being made.
There's some stuff on Wikipedia about that, so okay. What month did this come out? This came out in June?
March 1990.
Oh, so like literally like days to weeks before this movie came out is when, like, I mean, long story short, like the Soviet Union was in the process of collapsing through this whole period, and like events, like political events came to a head like literally a couple like weeks or a month before the movie came out. To the point that it was like they were genuinely freaked out that, like, oh, wait a minute, Soviet Union is going to not feel like any kind of threat by the time this movie hits theaters. Like, oh God, what are we going to do? So like that opening crawl at the beginning is actually like a very late in production addition to try to drive home like, oh, this happened in 84 when they were still scary, because like, right, oh boy, they sure are not a thing now.
I mean, it also makes sense in the context of, with Jack Ryan in the later movies, he is definitely a much more grizzled character, someone that has like seen a bunch of shit, whereas this version, Alec Baldwin's version, is supposed to be very much kind of on the come up, like despite the fact that he is still very clearly in his late 30s and kind of in the I'm writing books for the CIA part of my career, all his adventures have not really begun at this stage.
Is this actually based off of a missing Soviet sub from the 60s?
There are conflicting feelings about that. There okay. are a couple of stories about real life subs going missing over the decades, but this is not supposed to actually be based on any specific story.
Okay, because after there's a thing in that crawl that Brad, you mentioned, that's like, this is what, of course, this is what the, you know, U.S. government would never have you believe. And I was like, wait, is this actually a real thing? And then when I looked it up, it's like, you know, this could be based off of this missing sub from the 60s, whatever. And I wasn't sure if he was actually referencing something, or that's just some movie misdirection.
There is a fairly famous one. There used to be a documentary on Netflix about Project Azorian. I don't know if it's still on there. It's been years since I watched it. But like, yeah, that was an actual attempt to raise a sunken Soviet submarine, but it was like some time earlier. And I also don't think it had any like super top secret, like advanced technology on it necessarily.
Okay.
Like this.
I think Bob Ballard, the guy who found the Titanic, I want to say that whole mission to find it was financed by the government because they also wanted him to look for a Soviet sub while he was out there.
I believe that is the case. Oh, or I forget what it was they wanted to look for, but yes, I think there was absolutely a military aspect to that whole thing.
There was some subterfuge happening there.
Nice.
I have
that is him sneaking the nuke onto the Stargate-style shit.
There's something, I mean, we haven't gotten to the Caterpillar drive yet in the sub. Maybe I should save.
But yeah, I mean, that's as good a launching point as any, because they really early on, they're very much like, they tell you exactly what's going on here in the film. So the basic setup is, you know, the Russians are launching the Red October, which is the state of the art new submarine that is meant to be their basically their first strike weapon in a real nuclear war. It runs on a silent drive called the Caterpillar, which British intelligence, I think, is the first thing that gets wind of it, which is how it falls into the hands of Jack Ryan, who is in London at this point, who then immediately flies to the United States to brief James Earl Jones's character to be like, hey, they've got this thing. And then within about two scenes, it's like, oh no, not only is there this thing, but the entire Russian fleet is chasing this thing. And we know this is happening because Captain Mark Aurelius is on his own and out to defect. So about the Caterpillar dry, Brad, what did you want to say?
Oh, there's just in the Wikipedia article for this movie, there is perhaps the most amazing sentence I've ever read on that site. The film caused a minor sensation in the Black Project submarine warfare technology community.
Can you imagine that fucking news group on Usenet, like what those people were like?
That is the most highly specific niche community that's ever been described.
Like, they describe the Caterpillar drive as basically a jet engine for subs, where it's taking in water from the front and, like, squirting it out the back to run silent.
Yeah, I think it's, like, magnetically driven or something like that.
Yeah.
This could be a Caterpillar.
A what?
A Caterpillar drive. Magneto-hydrodynamic propulsion. You follow?
No.
It's like a jet engine for the water. Goes in the front. Get squirted out the back, only it's got no moving parts, so it's very, very quiet.
Like how quiet?
It's doubtful our sonar'd even pick it up. And if it did, it'd sound like whales humping or some kind of seismic anomaly, anything but a submarine. We messed with this a couple of years ago. We couldn't make it work. They really built this. This isn't a mock-up or anything.
She put to sea this morning.
When I was 12, I helped my daddy build a bomb shelter in our basement because some fool parked a dozen warheads 90 miles off the coast of Florida. This thing could park a couple of hundred warheads off Washington and New York, and no one would know anything about it till it was all over.
But it's also, you know, very much for the purposes of the movie, and I think life is a nuclear submarine as well. Running that thing off its nuclear power, also huge, which is what I remember as a kid from the movie, was like, man, this sub is like as big as a blue whale. Like, they just keep talking about how big this sub is, and everybody who sees it is like, that's a big one.
I think they describe it as being roughly the size of a World War II aircraft carrier.
Yes, they do.
Yes. Was that Richard Peck? Is he the one who says that?
That is Jeffrey Jones, who was the principal from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
I have to say
this before we get any deeper. I didn't know anybody that was in this movie besides Connery and Alec Baldwin.
Okay.
Like, I had no knowledge of the cast.
So you must have been excited and just pointing like, constantly, like, that guy!
I seriously, like, in the opening credits, at, like, four different fucking times, I was like, wait, what? Like,
Dr. Tim Curry.
It was like Tim Curry, and I was like, wait, what? And then it was James Earl Jones, and then it was Sam Neill, and then it was Stellan Skarsgård. I was just like, are you kidding me? Like, what?
Skarsgård is so awesome. He's probably my favorite character in this whole movie, because he's so underutilized.
Yeah, like, I wish there was more of him, but anyway.
He's pretty early in his career, I think.
Yeah, like everybody seemed very young.
Except for James Earl Jones, but also James Earl Jones is the only character or the only actor that is in all of the main Jack Ryan movies.
Oh,
like, he plays Admiral Greer through the Harrison Ford ones.
Huh.
My note for Baldwin is baby Baldwin, possibly younger than I even thought possible. Like, I could imagine a human being. Like, he looks like he is 15 in this.
They talk about him in the interviews like he was an unknown. I mean, you know, I think he had been in, like, Beetlejuice by this time.
This is 2 years after Beetlejuice.
Right. Like, but they, like, they flat out say, like, you know, the other casting fell through. They were like, we wanted to take a chance on a relative unknown because we knew this was a star-making role, is how they put it. Like, they literally said, like, we knew if we cast somebody like a babyface newcomer, they were going to come out of this a movie star. And, like, sure enough, I guess it kind of worked out.
Wow.
Anyway, the cast was just like, I was blown away. It was stacked.
It's good. I don't know. Like, this is probably a weird thing to say, but I think Connery is maybe the most not perfect casting. Like, everybody else does such a good job in it. Like, Sam Neill, I think, is great in it. Every U.S. cigar chomping cast from the, who's the sub commander of the Dallas?
Oh, that's Scott Glenn.
Yeah,
Scott
Glenn. He's
Bart
perfect.
Mancuso.
Yeah. Perfect. Who's the aircraft? aircraft carrier guy?
I love that offhand mention. Oh, that's Bert Mancuso's boat.
Yeah. Skipper.
Vinny, are you referencing Fred Thompson?
Yes,
oh,
Fred
God,
Thompson.
I forgot. Former U.S. Senator Fred Thompson.
Yeah, I forgot when Fred Thompson popped up. It was another one of those, like, come on.
Everybody, yeah. They all just seem, you know, they're all got their, like, okay. The guy who is in the briefing, everybody's got big glasses as well. The guy who's in the briefing.
Oh, yeah.
Who's the senator or the I'm a politician.
He's the national security advisor.
Okay. Mm-hmm. He's perfect. And then Sean Connery is like, he's okay in the role, but I think you could swap him out with somebody else and this movie still holds up. I
mean, speaking like one word at a time, his Scottish Russian.
Yeah. Yes. His attempts at Russian, but also like he just kind of doing Connery, right? Mm-hmm.
This is the stage of Connery's career where he had fully embraced the fact that he will never actually have to act again. Like, he can just be a version of Sean Connery forever, and he will keep making a lot of money doing that.
Like, I gotta say, though, having not seen this back in the day, like, just through cultural osmosis, like, he was the very image of a fearsome Soviet opponent to me in my, like, early teenage brain. Was just, like, with the hat, I forget what kind of hat that's called, but, like, the, you know, just the images of him.
Right.
Where he was just like the epitome of like, oh my God, like the Soviets are terrifying.
Like Connery's hair is amazing.
Yes.
Like,
the hair and beard combo is just. But yeah, like those early attempts at like, I knew they weren't going to be trying to speak bad Russian through the whole movie, but still the way that whole stuff, that whole thing plays out.
Speaking of that, Brad, I just want to call out one of my favorite scenes in cinema is the transition from Russian to English.
Yes.
It's so cool. It is such a great idea to start. So I'm assuming people have watched the movie at this point, but when they, you know, the guy, the political officer is reading from a book in Russian, camera zooms in. And then when it gets in, he switches to English and it zooms back out. And now we are still speaking Russian,
right.
But it just sounds like English to all of us.
See ya. Иду как тац, блажен, бодрствующий и хранящий одежду свою. И он собрал их на место, называемое по-еврейски Армагеддон. And the seventh angel poured forth his bowl into the air, and a voice cried out from heaven, saying, It is done.
It's just such a cool, like, it's one of those things that I used to have a teacher that, didn't like rack focus because she thought that it brought too much attention to the act of filming and brought you out of the movie. This is kind of one of those things, but I just appreciate it so much because it's just such a cool idea and executed very well.
It seems like it's kind of necessary for a lot of audiences. Like Chernobyl a few years ago had no Russian in it, mm-hmm. right? Everybody spoke mm-hmm. English, and like a lot of people had a real problem with that. Like that there were not even like bad Russian accents. There was like nothing to imply that they were speaking Russian, and like I didn't care, but like a lot of people really got hung up on that, and this kind of just like eases you into it in a way that pretty much kind of sidesteps that whole problem.
There's a couple of things about that scene. One, the political officer's name is Ivan Putin.
Yeah.
Which is just pure comedy in 2022. The other thing is that they chose the word Armageddon to make the switch because it is the same in both languages.
Oh, that's awesome.
So that was their pivot point.
That's cool.
It's a fairly slow zoom too, and I wasn't mm-hmm. quite sure what the hell was going on with this shot until they did the switch, and it was like, why are we zooming in on this person's mouth so much? Like we're framing in. Okay, this is your transition.
The scene also features the straight up, like I think the most stone cold murder anywhere in the Clancy oeuvre,
yes.
Because he basically breaks this motherfucker's neck in about 5 seconds, but he leaves him gasping on the floor for another 10 seconds after that, staring him right in the eye.
Oh, he stares right in the eye and then dumps a little bit of tea on him on the floor, and it's like,
whoops, slipped.
Like, I mean, as Bond, he's probably murked some fools, but man, Sean Connery just, oh, that, I, it's hard to feel bad for him. I mean, he's basically the state agent, right? He's
yes,
the person,
he's a political officer.
Yeah. So he's the one who's never going to go along with it. It's right after they, get their orders and they're all like, hey, you know, this is going to be great. Just, you know, make sure we follow the rules.
Yeah, because the only people who are in on this mutiny are most of the senior officers. Not all. Tim Curry's doctor is not, and a few handful of other people. But none of the crew are supposed to be in on this because they can't be trusted. Like, the people who are in on this conspiracy are all people who were trained by Ramius at various points. So they're in on this plot to bring the Red October to the United States and evade capture or destruction by the Russians, who are literally throwing everything they have at this this mission.
So they go into it a little bit, but why does he send the letter with their intentions to back to Russia?
His rationale was basically like, if you know that everybody's on your ass, you're going to work that much harder to make this happen because otherwise you're dead.
And you can't turn back.
And you can't turn back. Yeah. But then he says, like, I've got my own reasons as well. And he
states those at the very, very end.
Yeah, pretty close to the end, yeah.
I don't know if we want to jump ahead that far yet.
But, I mean, the basic gist of it is that, like, his wife passed away while he was still at sea.
Right.
And that kind of broke him.
Yeah, I think the guy he sent the letter to is his wife's uncle.
Who's also
Alec Baldwin's
but also, like, the head, mentions. Of the head of the Soviet Navy.
And in the book, they, again, hit you over the head a little more with, like, the Soviet Union is bad. Because it is explained that Ramius's wife died during a surgery performed by a drunk surgeon that does not get punished because he has political connections.
So I was waiting for some personal motivation like that to appear. Like, as much as they harped on his wife's death, I had to assume, like, okay, he's embittered about the Soviet Union because of something with his wife, right? But, like, it never came. I'm surprised they didn't put that detail in there.
I feel like the closest they get to that is that him just realizing, one, it's pathetic that I was, you know, out there, you know, on the sea when my wife was, you know, on land dying and I couldn't be there for her. And also, I'm staring at the blueprints of the ship, which literally only exists to start World War III, and I just can't sanction being a part of that.
Yeah, that's basically what he says toward the end, is that sub was only built for one purpose and, like, he couldn't allow that to happen.
And he's set up, at least in the movie, I don't know if it's the same in the book, I forget what he was. He's not a Russian.
He's Lithuanian.
He's Lithuanian.
Okay,
yeah.
Right.
Yeah, he mentions that he grew up in Vilnius.
Right. I mean, again, like, I think Connery plays it fine. He's very
He has the
stoic.
Gravity, if nothing else.
Yeah, yeah. And he doesn't really, he never really yells. Like, he's always kind of keeps his composure on the sub. And it's the reason I think I really appreciate this movie now, aside from all the political stuff that's, you know, pretty interesting about the Soviet Union, despite the propaganda pieces that are in it. You're filming 90% of the movie is on, like, three submarines, let's say. Tight quarters, there are, like, zero wide shots in the entire thing because there is just no room to get these shots. Sometimes on the con, there's, like, some group shots of everything, but everything is up in everybody's face, just sweating constantly on a submarine. Also, I'll just mention once Connery breaks that guy's neck, he lights the orders on fire in the tiny little room he's in. Is that, can you do that on a submarine?
You can if you're Sean Connery.
People, also, the amount of smoking on the boats in this movie is, like, nonstop, so I guess it's probably fine.
Yeah, literally, the engineer, who is the one that is always near the most nuclear parts of the boat, is constantly smoking, so...
Smoking. And then, I also, this is right after he snaps that guy's neck, and he's like, oh, well, I took his super secret key as well, the nuke key as well, is when you see Tim Curry, a fairly young Tim Curry, who's the ship's doctor, kind of being like, well, that's it, we're turning around, huh? And he's not in on the plan.
We don't, Tim Curry. We will not abandon our mission because of a simple accident.
You're blaming yourself, Captain. It was an accident. You'll feel better when we put in.
Put in?
Oh, to base, Captain. We cannot go on without a political officer.
Doctor, this is a combat vessel of the Soviet Navy, and I'm a senior combat officer. We do not cancel operations because of accidents. Seaman, come here.
Come here. Your name?
Cook's assistant, Loganov, sir.
Good. I want you and the doctor to witness this. I'm removing the political officer's missile key. Carry on. And I'm keeping it myself.
Captain, I think we should report this to Red Fleet Command.
I'm afraid that's impossible, Doctor. Our orders are for strict radio silence. Order, sir.
That's all, Loganov.
Yes, sir.
This is most unnerving, Captain. The reason for having two missile keys is so that no one man may...
May what?
May arm the missiles. Perhaps I should keep the key.
Thank you, that'll be all, Doctor.
Captain,
when I address the crew, then you will understand.
Yes, that's right. He's Tim Curry. I like him in this role. He is like, he plays kind of the naive kind of nationalist who thinks everything is, he comes off as everything is fine, everything is great.
Oh, he loves the Soviet Union. He's stoked.
He is all in. Just happy to
be there.
You will
receive the Order of Lenin for this, Captain.
Yeah. That's right. Yeah.
And he looks so, like, that is maybe the single best piece of acting in this movie, is the face of, like, the wash of pride that comes over his face when he hears that they're going to scuttle the ship. He's like, you will receive the Order of Lenin for this. Like, it's so good.
He's,
yeah.
The other guys that I'll just say as we move along here that I love are the interaction between the diplomat from Russia.
Yes, Jonas Åkerlund, who is perhaps best known as the diplomat from Lethal Weapon 2.
That's right.
Diplomatic immunity.
Diplomatic immunity.
Also plays kind of a scumbag here, but now as a Russian who has
to sit on a couch for this entire movie,
eating whatever it is, Skittles, against the Secretary of State?
That's the National Security Advisor.
National Security Advisor. They have a great just shit eating. Both of them know they're lying out their ass back and forth each time. Of like, we've had an incident. Oh, really? Oh, okay. Because the movie's set up in a way where you, the viewer, get debriefed constantly on what's going on. You know way more than everybody's letting on. Then you get these scenes where they're like, oh, tell me what happened.
Well, oh, it's a rescue operation. Oh, we are, tell us where to go. We'll send our boats to help.
How can we help?
Yeah, can we help? You lost another step. Yeah, yeah. It's great. Those scenes are fantastic. Like that.
I would say... Sorry, Vinny.
No, they're just fun to watch.
Yeah, I think the exposition here, and like, because it's kind of a complicated thing, everything that's going on, everybody's motivations. I think they do a really natural job of keeping the audience up to speed. And I think, you know, that just echoes what I was saying before about how I love the script so much.
Yeah, it's
tight. Like, you got the greenhorn sonar operator
Jonesy.
That Jonesy explains everything to. So we know what the baffles are.
Mm-hmm. I'm sorry, no, Jonesy, you know, is the one who has like the super hearing. I forget what the name of the kid is. The guy who looks like Gabriel Knight 2.
Yes. Yeah, and then is it the second in command that keeps giving Jonesy a hard time with the right. Pavarotti?
I think he's the chief petty officer, because like the second in command is the guy with the gigantic glasses that takes over the sub while Mancuso's on October. Okay.
Was it captain of the boat or chief of the boat? I forget. He had some CO something. They're all very, the casting is all very good. Jonesy's great. I have in my notes, Jonesy is the real hero of this movie.
Oh, absolutely. Yes.
Yeah. Jonesy is the person who deciphers the Caterpillar drive.
Yeah, because the computer doesn't know what to do with it. It doesn't, like, it's not a sound that he's used to hearing, because he knows exactly what Russian subs sound like. But because it does make a sound, it's just not a sound that sounds like an engine, at least not to the, you know, the naked ear. But he figures out that the thing that the computer thinks is a magma displacement is probably some kind of Russian boat. And the way he figures this out is by speeding up the sound to 10 times speed and making it sound like an engine, I guess.
Yeah, well, he's able to detect an extremely rigid, consistent pattern.
Yeah.
And at that point, he's like, okay, there's no way. That's not man-made.
Right.
Sir, the moment that sub went silent and I thought I heard some singing, I heard something in the background, real faint. And then, after all those subs took off, I caught it again, and I managed to get it on tape. I washed it through the computer a few times, and I was able to isolate this sound. When I asked the computer to identify it, what I got was magma displacement. See, sir, the SAPS software was originally written to look for seismic events. And I think when it gets confused, it kind of runs home to Momo.
I'm not following you, Joshi.
Sir, I'm sorry. Listen to it at 10 times speed. Now that's gotta be man-made, Captain.
I think that's a cool part.
There are two things I love in thrillers. People deciphering audio through, like, crazy trickery, and also people plotting courses and drawing a straight line on a map to a thing that you don't know what it is, but you know it's significant. And this scene has both those things.
I love that they're super secret. Like, world-ending sonar-defeating technology is made irrelevant in the first, like, 30 minutes. Like, this guy immediately cracks a method of, like you know that, like, billions are immediately going to be spent on a new type of detection that's just going to be able to track those things like nothing.
Jonesy's the hero. Other parts that I love in this movie is them, what feels like them sitting down and be like, how do we make sub chases seem dramatic and intense as two relatively slow lumbering things.
Well, especially the Red October, which they describe as this thing controls like a hog.
Yeah. Like, these things have to go. And I think they do a great job. Like, it's very tense. I remember this as a kid, the Crazy Ivan stuff. Like, I mean, I assume they didn't just make that
Crazy
up.
Ivan.
Which is just basically the most thrilling thing of a sub doing a U-turn to see if anybody's behind it. But it becomes the most tense thing in the movie because you have to shut everything down. And it's just looking, it's just a sub looking over its shoulder for a little bit. It's great.
The first time they introduce that, the scene where they are cutting back and forth between the Dallas when they first experience a Crazy Ivan and Jonesy is explaining to the, you know, the greenhorn what that even means. But they're also cutting between the very emotional, quiet conversation that Ramius and his first officer, Sam Neill, Vasily, are having is, I think, the single best moment of non-action tension in the movie. It's well done.
That sequence really stood out to me because, yes, they are intercutting extremely different, like, scenes with extremely different, like, levels of excitement and kind of tones and everything, and, like, that's just so unusual to see how much was going on at one time. It worked surprisingly well for how, like, clumsy that could have been.
The movie was nominated for Best Editing.
Yeah, the editing is great, and the cinematography is amazing. I would say the cinematographer this is Jan de Bont, who went on to become a director of Speed and Twister.
Okay.
Oh, awesome.
He got his start as a cinematographer, and then he decided to make extremely dumb action movies, which I don't mind at all.
It's beautifully shot, and like I said, for close quarter stuff, it's really intense. Like, the lighting is also very good.
I really appreciated the distinct visual language of the different nationalities subs, like, especially once you get into the tense, like, bridge to bridge kind of Wrath of Khan maneuvering, because like the Soviet sub is, like, super dark and, like, very blue, a lot of blue lighting in the background, like a lot of shiny chrome looking stuff.
Yeah, everything is black and chrome, whereas the U.S. stuff is, like, all gray.
Yeah, it's, like, it's brighter, it's gray, there's a lot more red around, like, it's just super easy to, like, when they cut back and forth, like, it's really distinct, like, who you're looking at any given time.
There's also, again, just to kind of amp up the tension in this, in a movie that maybe doesn't need the dramatic subs, like, look how cool subs are, they're, like you said, Top Gun, is the navigating, what is it, Thor's twins? Mm-hmm. The like, where Sean Connery wants them to go faster, and they're, you know, I don't necessarily know exactly why he wants to push it faster. Nobody's chasing them at that point necessarily. They don't know yet.
I feel like
right.
I feel like the implication there is that he just wants to show off because he can.
I feel like
And I think they also need something to be happening while the sabotage happens,
right?
Because that's when the Caterpillar drive gets borked.
Yes.
And then they have to go to regular propulsion, and that's when the airplane sees them and drops a torpedo.
Yes.
And that airplane is, that's a U.S. airplane?
No, that was a Russian plane.
No, that was a Russian plane.
Okay, so that's the Russian plane.
They say drops a torpedo. Later on that, like, they are dropping sonar buoys everywhere to try and find this thing, so much that you could walk from Greenland to Iceland.
That's a good line, yeah.
And yeah, so that plane is basically just trying to find them so they can just fucking smoke them if they find them.
Right. Okay. And then that torpedo, that's the one where they cut very last minute and it goes into the
yeah.
Well, The first one, they run into it before it can arm itself. They basically, that very first one that comes out of the plane, I think they go full speed ahead at it. And remember, it kind of bounces off of them in pieces.
I thought that was later.
The first one is the one that runs into Thor's twins, and that is...
oh, you're right. I'm sorry.
And yes, it shakes the boat, and it freaks out some of the crew. It's like, why are they shooting at us? Why is Russia shooting at us?
Like, live munitions. What's going on here? And they...
If they wanted us dead, we'd be dead.
Yeah, they never really seem to pacify the crew on that. They just kind of forget about it.
They rank and file kind of get forgotten about in this movie a lot, it feels like.
Speaking of things we almost forgot about, I almost forgot we need to take a break. So let's go ahead and do that right now. All right, so meanwhile...
And then, meanwhile, while all this is happening, I guess Jack Ryan is, first of all,
rushing from place to place.
They do this like real throwaway scene in the beginning where he can't sleep on planes because of turbulence. And then, you know, do a kind of gag later on where he's just in the most turbulent weather. And is that okay? Is the guy who's telling him that he puked on all the dashboard and stuff? Is that comic? Oh, gosh. He was in The Burbs, the neighbor, the guy who does the power lines.
Oh, I don't know.
do you know who I'm talking about?
It's hard to tell because he's wearing a lot of headgear, but it could be.
It sounds like him. The guy who finds the femur. This is whatever's in The Burbs. He was around a lot in the 80s.
Could have been. There's a lot of people who play small roles in, like, pilot roles and other things that are actual military personnel. They just roped in for stuff. I don't think that guy is, but...
Okay.
The guy who pilots the little mini sub later on, not the guy who talks, but the one who just pilots, is actually like a naval officer. So
there's a guy, the guy hooking Baldwin up for his helicopter descent, also has a real military cadence to his line delivery too.
Yeah, there's a lot of that.
I'm thinking of the guy's name. I'm thinking of is Rick Ducommun.
I have no idea. It's a guy from the Burbs. Literally don't know.
Anyway, they set up this thing where I guess they're just trying to make Jack Ryan seem like kind of a book nerd, you know, like no field experience.
Yeah, he's just an analyst.
He's just an analyst. But then when he
writes books for the CIA.
But then when he gets on the aircraft carrier, what does he say? Like he survived. His fourth year was spent in like a
in traction.
He was in a helicopter crash.
He was a
sole survivor of a helicopter crash in the Marines and spent 10 months learning to walk again. It's because they stick him in a naval uniform as a like cover,
right?
For why he's heading to this aircraft carrier in the middle of nowhere. You know, they're trying to disguise who he is,
right?
And I don't know who that guy is who's there with Fred Thompson. Is he like the second officer?
Oh,
or,
so I was actually going to ask you about that. He is one of two Star Trek: The Next Generation actors who make an appearance in this film. Gates McFadden plays.
Oh God, that was the pinnacle of my wait. What the fuck? Who is in this movie? See,
yeah.
Gates McFadden at the beginning of this.
So. His wife plays a much more significant role in later Jack Ryan movies and is replaced by Ann Archer as the actress. But yes, Gates McFadden plays Jack Ryan's wife in one scene here. And then this actor, his name is, hang on, Daniel Davis. He's the guy who plays Moriarty in all the
no.
the Sherlock stuff.
No.
Yes.
What? Oh,
yes.
Man, no stovetop hat. It was kind of hard to tell.
But yes, that is that actor.
I'm looking at him right now, huh?
So he's the captain of that boat, whereas Fred Thompson is a rear admiral, and he is in command of the fleet that's out there.
I don't think I put that together. Either.
Yeah, I thought Fred Thompson was the captain of the ship. But anyway, the other guy is not pleased about Jack Ryan wearing that uniform because he thinks he doesn't deserve it. And that's when his whole backstory about like he's really put in his time comes out.
And then the fucking is it the F-16 crashes into the fucking deck, and then it's like this shit's gonna get worse before it gets better. And that's like their big another weird scene that just is
this is
for escalation.
This is an iconic line actually. It's this will get out of control. The situation will get out of control, and yeah, like it is
something along the lines of like we'll be lucky to live through it or something like that.
This business will get out of control. It'll get out of control and we'll be lucky to live through it.
I think that's kind of a nod to so much of the time in the book spent on like you put US forces and Russian forces close enough together and something bad is going to happen.
Yeah.
But that plane clipped like a friendly, right? Is that not what happened? Is that,
I can't remember if it was a friendly or if they happened to just bump up against a Russian plane, but whatever it was, yeah, like it was losing fuel and was going to crash.
So they stick old Jack Ryan on a helicopter, try to drop him onto a sub, which goes poorly. I remember this as a kid too. I still don't understand it as an adult. Is there static buildup from propellers on helicopters? Is that a real thing?
Yeah, apparently. Because I don't fly no helicopters, but I believe it. That's the whole stunt looks great.
Mm.
Yes, they built a model version of the ship, which is, I think it was like parts of two freighters that they just kind of mashed together, and it only covered the above part of the boat, so they could shoot.
Oh, that's wild.
Because they couldn't use a real sub, obviously, for this.
Yeah.
But yeah, like that scene is, I think, probably one of the single most tense things anywhere in the movie, because again, you visually can't fully tell what's going on there, and like they only throw that rotor static electricity thing shouted amid the din of everything else going on. So you're not really sure what the stakes here are. But as soon as that guy gets electrocuted and knocked over the boat, you're like, oh, God, this is going horribly.
Don't forget that the helicopter is into its like 10 minutes of emergency, right, like only to be used in wartime fuel. like the helicopter is not going to make it back if they stay for like another minute.
If you don't get me on that boat, war is just what you'll have.
Right.
Which is also great. Because it's after Jack Ryan is not going to make it, and they're like, well, we're going around. He unclips, he goes into the drink. They do say, into the water, and they do say at some point there's a line that's like, we have a diver in the hatch.
Yeah, I think every U.S. sub has divers.
Yeah, so they have one ready. But as soon as he unclips, they're like, the helicopter's like, we're out of here.
Right, yep, all right, that's that. Peace. Goodbye.
This is your mess. Like, I don't even know if he's hit the water by that point. I think they say, like, you got a diver? Good. We're out of here. You figure out. You fish him out.
From the interviews that I was watching, that downward shot from the helicopter of Alec Baldwin where he's looking up and it's him, he suggested that to McTiernan, like, not as a joke, but as a, like, wouldn't it be cool if we could do this? Like, wouldn't it be cool if you get a shot of me from above in the helicopter? McTiernan was like, yeah, that would be cool. Let's do that. And actually made him do it.
So he was on the line. He was, he was hanging out there.
Yeah.
It's a cool thing. I mean, it's ridiculous. The whole thing. They pull him into the sub and he explains, it's actually pretty quick. It's faster than I remember. Like, he gets him on board with the whole defection thing with his, was it the crazy, the next crazy Ivan?
Oh yeah. Yes.
In the bottom of the hour.
Bottom of the hour. Which
we kind of skipped over this detail, but like the whole thing with Ryan in this is that he has written about Ramius and he has met Ramius one time, but at the same time, like, no one else is like trucking with this theory necessarily. Everyone kind of, and the Russians are saying he's gonna launch an attack. Like he just fakes his way through that entire conversation. Is like, I need you to listen to me, so I'm just gonna say starboard and hope this fucking works. And then later is pressed on that, and he's like, yeah, no, I lied.
The official line out of Russia is Sean Connery is going to nuke the United States. He's rogue, and he's going to, and so that's what they're telling the United States. And Jack Ryan is trying to get everybody on his side about this defection plot.
Yeah, I feel like they walk just up to the line of pushing the cliche too far of the, like, the mythological, like, wise commander that is unknowable and, like, is smarter and more tactical than anybody on the planet. You know what I mean? It's like, like, almost one too many instances of him, like, showboating some sequence of orders that the rest of the crew is, like, losing their minds. Like, we're all gonna die. He's gonna get killed. And then, of course, it turns out he was right, you know, and, like, the whole, like, oh, I know his mind. I know what he'll do. Like, he's, you know. But Connery is just such an imposing presence pretty much every time he's on the screen that I feel like they get away with it.
Yeah, like there's the big one, right, where they finally get over to the Red October, the captain of the Dallas and Jack Ryan, and they have to outmaneuver a torpedo, and that's the big one, right, where it's like Connery says early on, he's like, I know all of their tactics, he's like, I've got the upper hand. And so it's actually, I think, one of the cooler scenes in the movie where they turn into the torpedo and he's able to hit it before it arms, and it just kind of shatters against the hull. And meanwhile, the, you know, skipper from the Dallas is like, what the fuck, man? He's about to get us all killed. And Jack Ryan?
No, Ryan, don't do that. You're going to get us killed.
Yeah. And Ryan sides with the Russians. I just gotta say, he just takes his word over, you know, and does. It's sad because that's Skarsgård's boat, and I think he's so just criminally underused in his tiny close-up U-boat. Everything in there is so claustrophobic. Every time they show him, the camera is about 4 inches from his face, and he's so intense the entire time. And then they just do zero character development with him.
I love him, and I wish he was in more of this.
This is pretty early on for Skarsgård, so I feel like he was not commanding, like, hey, I need to be an X number of scenes level actor at that point.
But they don't really, like, you feel like, even from the little he's on there, I think you feel like, oh, there's some rivalry here, and, like, he must have, like, beat him out in some rank, and he's this these gaps.
I think they say it, that, like, Ramius trained him.
Yeah, but they don't put together some, like, Jedi Padawan, like, Anakin, right. You know. But in my mind, it was all happening, like, oh, he was supposed to be the next, and he got posted here, because he's just out for blood. He's just out to kill him.
Ramius does kind of disdain him, because, you know, like, I forget what the conversation is, but it's something along the lines of, like, God, what is his name? Topolov?
Tupolev, yeah.
Like, he basically says, like, he's like, there's no room in Topolov's heart for anyone but Topolov, or something like that. Like, he doesn't exactly look kindly on him.
I think go ahead, Vinny. Sorry.
Well, no, I was going to say that whole part is very cool. Just with the torpedo hitting sub.
It was a genuine, like, okay, how is this going to resolve? Like, every other time they've done this, like, something happened, and of course something does happen here to get him out of it, but, like, they really push this one as far as it can go.
I think kind of the ultimate knowing thy enemy is the back and forth between Ramius and Ryan over this communicating without communicating that they're doing with the pings. Like, right. I love that scene too, where it's like, okay, Scott Glenn says, you know, open the torpedo doors. And then Ramius says, flood the tubes, but don't open the doors. And then we ping, and then we Morse code with each other. It's all just, it's so tense, and you understand what's happening. And it's just this fine walking of lines, you know, a lot like a lot of Cold War stuff. So I like that scene a lot.
Yeah, like you want it.
Only Vasily.
Like you want it to happen at that point, right? Like you're like at that point, his motivations have been revealed enough that, like, you realize, like, okay, like, Ramius is actually, like, a pretty good dude. Like, his intentions are good here. Like, you are rooting for them to succeed in their plan, right?
I had remembered, and as everybody who has seen this movie, I definitely remembered the one ping only. Mm-hmm. I hadn't remembered the awkwardness of him doing it twice, and, like, Sam Neill having to be like, why would you do that?
Everybody's already verified our range.
Everybody's gonna know something is up on the ship.
Re-verify our range to target. One ping only.
Captain, I just...
Give me a ping, Vasily. One ping only, please.
Aye, Captain.
I totally had didn't register the first time of, like, oh, this makes no tactical sense at all. You're just sending a verification here, which was cool to see again. Like, Sam Neill, I think, also does an amazing part of being kind of the foil. Like, where Sean Connery is confident and kind of feels like he is one step ahead, Sam Neill is kind of the audience surrogate for, like, this could fall apart any second.
I do also like the part where Ryan has Mancuso send Morse code about Ramius's intentions to him, and he guesses correctly, and you get that shot of Sean Connery, like, flabbergasted that someone knows what I'm up to.
Yes.
Like, jumps the one back from the periscope.
Part of acting.
Wait your whole life to find someone who understands you.
Yeah.
It's when he sends the, like, if you go to America, you'll be shot dead in the water kind of thing. Like, if you won't make it out of there.
I do have to give it up for Sam Neill for, like, kind of just disappearing into that role. Like,
yeah.
I kind of forgot I was watching Sam Neill at points, and I was just like, oh, this is just a Russian officer. I do think it's a little silly how inconsistent they are with making some of the actors use Russian accents. And meanwhile, Connery is just over here being Connery, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because like Sam Neill was putting on an accent pretty noticeably.
Yeah.
There's only so much you can really ask of Sean Connery at this stage of his career. He's going to do what he's going to do.
Yeah.
Sam Neill is legitimately one of my favorite actors, though, and I feel like this run he had in the 90s is about as good as any actor had between this and Jurassic Park and various other things.
And he just wants to see Montana.
He just wants to see Montana. He wants to marry a plump American woman. He wants her to raise rabbits for him, and he wants an RV.
Yes, he wants the...
No papers.
No papers.
Do you think they would let me live in Montana?
I would think they'll let you live wherever you want.
Good. Then I will live in Montana. And I will marry a round American woman and raise rabbits. And she will cook them for me. And I will have a pickup truck. Or possibly even a recreational vehicle. And drive from state to state. Do they let you do that?
Yes.
No papers?
No papers. State to state.
It's, yeah, he's great, and then he eats it.
And he gets, yeah.
It's so bad every time. Every time I watch it, it kills me.
Yeah.
Because that you get that really tender scene, and it's, yeah, it's tough.
So the plan here is to get the crew off the boat. This is how all this gets set into motion. They have a plan. It's not 100% clear whether this was always the exact plan or if they just moved things up because, you know, the situation had changed. But they found a way to get the crew off the boat, which is to fake a radiation leak. Mm-hmm. And so they surface. They try and get all the crew off the boat onto the lifeboats. A U.S. battleship shows up, does its part to pretend that it's there to steal the ship. And then Ramius does his thing where he's like, we'll go below and we'll scuttle the ship.
Yes.
And everyone's very impressed with him.
So brave.
And so they fake a torpedo, which James Earl Jones is there to hit the button, which is another great shot in this movie of just his finger kind of lingering over the explode button. But then the other Russian sub shows up, and that's where the big battle takes place. But all the stuff leading up to that also involves the saboteur, who is the cook, who is, of course, the one crew member that is not, you know, named at any point, but shows up in multiple scenes. Of course, that's the guy.
Yeah, we haven't touched on it that much, that they've been having, like, increasing incidents of sabotage, and it's becoming increasingly ominous that they don't know who it is, and this may screw everything up.
Okay, he's not in the cabal, right? He's outside of the main group.
No, presumably he is KGB or so something. He is some kind of like. I wonder. Like,
I had to go look this up afterwards because they don't really spell out who he is and why he would be trying to sabotage this whole effort. He is a GRU officer.
Like a plant on the boat.
And so as soon as I read that, I remembered that. Remember the very first scene with the political officer?
Yeah,
yes.
I wouldn't even know it.
Yeah, he was like Connery is quizzing him on like, so you've got operatives on here, huh? And he was like, Captain, if the KGB or the GRU were to plant officers on or operatives on this boat, I would be the last to know.
Yeah.
So like that, then I remembered between that and also the cook is who witnesses him taking that key, right? So like,
yes.
At that point, I think that's how you're supposed to put together that like, oh, that guy was actually the plant.
So that's a pretty big coincidence then, that the GRU officer was the guy who witnessed the key.
Or that guy was just so plugged in and dialed into what was happening on the ship, he knew to be in that space to make sure he saw what was going on.
Could be.
Which is also kind of weird because, I don't know, you're the cook and she just like poison everybody and just kind of like, maybe there's not poison on the ship. I don't know. Like sabotaging the Caterpillar drive and then threatening to just blow up the entire submarine seems, I mean, I guess it's not extreme. I don't know. He snuck aboard, right? Like after they get everybody in, and Sean Connery says, make sure you have a good head count, which again, Tim Curry, do your damn job.
Well, he may have been like assigned, you know, he may have been maneuvered into an assignment or something.
I don't know.
Yeah. And the other thing is that like, you know, as much as that sabotage stuff, like obviously he's going to pretty extreme lengths. if this maiden voyage had just gone normal, I'm sure this guy wouldn't have done anything. He would have just been sitting there observing, and they reported back, like, yes, no, everything went great. Ramius, top-notch captain, all good.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Like, the second they realize he's going to defect and turn this, like, advanced technology over to the Americans, like, their number one priority is destroy this at any cost so they can't get their hands on it, so...
Right.
And also, like, him blowing up the ship at the end, you know, I'm sure that's just, like, you know, sacrifice yourself for the cause of the glorious motherland or whatever.
I guess the GRU thing does explain how a cook knows how to hotwire a nuclear missile.
Yeah, that's...
God, does he ever. What? Like, after Sam Neill takes the bullet that saves, you know, Ramius's life, him and Ryan go a-hunting. and, yeah, like, I forgot how quickly Ramius just gets taken out of the equation in this. Mm-hmm. Like, it's literally, they walk down a hallway, then it's like, whoops, bullet to the shoulder, you're not doing anything.
Yes.
And then, you know, Jack Ryan has to do his little, you know, his little shimmy dance down the catwalk to try and catch this guy. And yes, he's just sitting there holding two wires that it is implied that as soon as he touches those things, everything goes sky high.
Jack, they also have a shootout in the missile bay where, you know, Sean Connery says, hey, watch, these things don't react nicely to bullets. But also, I assume he's got a handgun. They're firing, like, tens of bullets, like he's firing constantly at him.
I don't react well to bullets.
Yeah. Ryan, some things in here don't react well to bullets. Yeah, like me, I don't react well to bullets.
I do like when, you know, kind of this whole time when they get to the sub is this fun meeting of the worlds, and I just love it when that happens in movies. Like, they stand looking at each other across the con for, like, a minute before Alec Baldwin breaks the ice by trying to smoke a cigarette.
They're looking at each other, but also, like, the U.S. guys are definitely, like, eyeing the bridge and kind of looking around the ship like, oh, man, this thing is fucking cool. Like, Jonesy in particular seems like he is just eyeballing every piece of tech in there. And it's great. Yeah, like, that scene where they kind of, like, try to break the ice is just a great bit of... this is super awkward, and there's no way it not to be super awkward.
Yeah, their engineer is great. The Egon Spengler guy is fantastic.
I enjoyed Alec Baldwin speaking what, to my untrained ear, sounded like pretty good Russian, and then Connery just comes right back with English. You know, it's just like, yes, we have met each other on a mutual level of respect.
Kakovny but Bakaru. So funny.
The captain seems to think you're some sort of cowboy.
New Paroski.
Немного. Полезно знать, что думает противник. Не правда ли?
It is.
And then Alec Baldwin gets really wet. Like, he gets soaked.
Yeah, pipe lands on him.
Is it soaking wet in this, like, kind of dripping shot of him saturated, and then just shoots that dude as he's got the two wires together, and that's kind of the resolution of the whole thing. Oh, well, they kind of blow up the Hunter sub from the Soviets. Everybody, the crew who's waiting in the boats, is super sad, take off their hats because they believe that either Connery has scuttled the ship or it has been destroyed by the Americans. I'm not sure which they believe, but either way, it is an honorable death. You're like, oh, he's fighting back. It's pretty good dumb shit happening up there.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And you get a big breach of the Dallas.
Yes.
That blows the tubes.
Yes.
Way to go, Dallas.
Scared him out of the water.
Shout out to Dave Snyder.
I thought that happened more in this movie. Is there another movie where they blow the emergency surface more? Another sub movie? Because
probably.
I thought they're doing it like seven times. Like blow.
It's basically the separating the saucer of sub movies. Mm-hmm.
I realized relatively early on in this that I was like, oh wow, this is just Star Trek. Like, oh wait, have I actually always loved submarine movies and just like Emily now backfilling that experience because it's like, oh, this is actually just like taut maneuvering on two bridges between like steely-eyed commanders. Wow, this rules.
Yeah, I feel like the thing Star Trek sometimes gets wrong is that they compare it more to like boat combat and boat, you know, like tactics. But the thing is, I think starships in Star Trek are much more like submarines in that the entire surrounding environment is hostile to them and everything is about navigating that. Whereas you know, like, I, as much as they love their big, like, dress them up in 17th century naval gear and, you know, do their little holodeck boat things, like, nah, these are sub-commanders, 100%.
Right. Yeah, but just from a dramatic standpoint, that, like, you know, facing off of, like, these, you know, like, high-level intellects and all the maneuvering and stuff is yeah. very, very entertaining.
I do think this movie, at least of the movies I've seen, has the best shot sub-combat of anything I've seen. Like, it is... All that stuff is done really well. It both communicates the incredibly lumbering nature of these machines, but also the way that they can be very maneuverable when they are, you know, when the commanders know what they're doing. Like, all the visual language they use to communicate that stuff is great. And, you know, for, again, for a movie that has several, like, numerous scenes where just big blobs of black are moving through big blobs of dark blue, they get a lot out of that.
Jonesy, when he's on the Red October, because they have a skeleton crew at that point, right? And that's why Baldwin,
it's just the officers
he's piloting at that point.
Yeah, that was cool.
Is that when he does the way to go Dallas, when he's on the
yes,
okay
yes, it's when Dallas, so they steered into that first torpedo, but the second one they can't do, so Dallas pulls that jack move where basically it makes the torpedo acquire them instead, and that's when they blow, they get up.
I would like to hear from somebody who is more knowledgeable about submarines if that whole reacquiring the target with a torpedo is possible to kind of because it's basically taken on, it's three targets at that point, right? It's the Red October, mm-hmm. then it's the Dallas.
It's the Alpha class.
What is it? You've killed us.
You've killed us.
You idiot.
That's...
You arrogant ass. You've killed us.
That's pretty good. But, like, you think that's ridiculous? Or is that, like, some curving the bullet in a movie kind of thing?
I mean, well, the sub breaching, that's definitely, I think that's a real shot of a sub doing
that.
Oh,
sure,
yeah.
They
may not have done it for the movie, but whether that breaks the, you know, the signal of a torpedo, I don't know. Mm. I actually do have a friend who works for the Navy on submarine targeting systems, so
okay.
Maybe I'll ask him.
Gonna need
you
want to
give him
up.
A ring ding ding and come back for next time, let us know.
He should really be on this podcast instead of me.
No, we go for the star power, and the star power is Drew Scanlon.
I don't know a ton about that stuff, but I have read, like, early sonar targeted torpedoes, like, there were problems with them, like, circling around and targeting the thing that shot them and stuff like that.
Yeah.
So I think it is probably a pretty, like, fuzzy science.
In my memory, so along with the not remembering exactly how the one ping thing went, in my memory, I remember Jonesy screaming way to go down. It's like jumping out of his chair, but it's much more muted.
I mean, he's pretty excited, but
he's
it's not
excited.
Like him jumping out of his chair.
Yeah. I was like, oh, that's not how I remembered it. In my mind's eye, he's like leaping out of the chair at that moment.
Speaking of former giant bomb engineers, the guy who's running or like monitoring the torpedoes next to Jim Greer on the battleship, like, that torpedo's still active, looks very much like Will Carl.
Yes, I thought that
you
same
know he
thing.
Does.
Yes,
now that you mention it,
I thought that same thing. That whole part is very tense. I think they do some good submarine battle stuff there for what submarine, you know, what is. Like Brad was getting to, it's kind of a big space battle, right? Like, you know, they make the subs seem very close to each other, but I don't know if that's some movie
it's
magic.
It's hard to tell relative distance in a submerged, you know, tank of water, which is, so they didn't use, like, computer effects really weren't much of a thing at this point, at least, or they were very much in their nascent stage. So the only real computer effects they used in this movie were for, like, little water things like bubbles and other things like in the, but I think almost all the sub stuff is models.
Torpedoes don't look so great.
There was that sick rotating 3D model of a sub in the very beginning on Alec Baldwin's laptop in that montage of boat books and stuff.
Yes. Yes.
That man is such a bookworm.
Oh yeah.
Just so you know, is bona fides out of
and a 3D modeler.
It's interesting because I don't know if you guys have seen all the other, you know, Clanceverse movies, but this one, there's something I mostly noticed watching it this time while I was thinking about it. This movie's almost more of an ensemble cast than really any of the other Jack Ryan stuff is going forward. Like, Clear and Present Danger is probably the one that's closest to this. But there are large stretches where this movie is not about Jack Ryan. Like, there's a lot of stuff that happens on the Dallas that is all about them. There's tons of stuff on the Red October that has nothing to do with Jack Ryan. Whereas after this, Jack Ryan kind of turns into the most important man in the world in all those movies. Like, he is the guy who saves everyone and everything all the time. Whereas here, I mean, again, it is kind of his first big adventure, but, like, until he gets on the Dallas, the only real scene he has where he is, like, doing something really significant is in that briefing where he's, like, thrust into duty to, like, explain to all these suits, like, hey, what's going on here? But otherwise, like, he's just kind of fumbling around until he is forced to, you know, kind of forced to do something.
Yeah, I did love that scene with the overhead slides.
Yes. Do we have a picture of him?
So, yeah, I mean, they wind up happy ending, right? Like, they wind up sailing into the sub down a river.
Yeah. Eric Pope's there on the shore just hanging out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Like, all I knew was Alec Baldwin, Sean Connery, and I wish I could have seen Montana. Like, that was all I knew about this movie.
Okay.
But based on the latter of those, I did not expect Sean Connery or the ship to survive. I was like, I spent the whole movie just assuming that Connery would die and the ship would be sunk. And then, like, you know, at the beginning, they tell you in the crawl that the sub was sunk, and I just was like, oh, that was just like a bold choice to just go ahead and give away the ending, and then you can focus on the tension and how they get there and stuff. I did not expect the bait and switch at the end, and I super did not expect the, like, I don't want to call it corny, but the river, the little river cruise at the end was like, I was like, oh, that's a happier, tidier ending than I was expecting out of this thing.
It is.
Yeah, it's a very celebratory little emotional moment between them that is lit incredibly. They are definitely on a green screen there.
Yeah.
And it's supposed to be night, but also it feels like they shot it day for night, despite the fact that they are on a green screen, which is really interesting.
Yeah. The green screen make them look like ghosts sometimes.
It's almost stylized in how obvious it is.
Yeah.
It's corny.
Kind of like a front screen projection almost.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you get was it Andres? You lost another submarine. is that the very end? Or I think that's
the part that comes right before. Oh, okay. The river is like the last shot of that just sailing off down the river.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's where that banter kind of establishes that, like, the Soviets think the Red October was sunk when in fact it was the other one. Although you would think, since they also lost another sub, they might be a little suspicious. Yeah. I guess they are suspicious, but they have no,
like, because the technology does not exist yet for them to correctly identify which sub has been sunk at that depth, they just can't know.
Well, yeah, the very last scene is Ryan asleep on the plane.
Yes, oh, he's gotten over it. He's too tired.
And Stanley has a brother.
Aww.
So you said this is the director who did Die Hard?
Yes, Die Hard and Predator.
Stuffed animals. It's Gotta get the kid the stuffed animal for the birthday.
I also want to give a shout out to the incredible score by Basil Poledrus. Mm-hmm. Poledrus?
Is that how you
who
say
also
it?
Did it? I don't know.
Polydorus. Yeah.
Okay. He also did another of my favorites, Starship Troopers, along with RoboCop.
Conan.
If you need a guy with marching snares, this is your guy.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the soundtrack is really good. Like, the opening, you know, choral singing is really effective. The part where the guys are singing on the boat is such a great moment of, you know, like, and to the point where Jonesy can hear it once they've gone to the silent running. Like, that's such a good bit. The way they use the music in this movie, I feel like, is super effective.
Yeah, the soundtrack, it's amazing. And it opens strongly, too. It's Connery on the tower, right?
Madriga.
Cool. It's very silly. I mean, it's not silly. It's not supposed to be silly. Connery is silly.
Connery's Connery. He's always going to be Connery.
Yeah. Yeah. I think this is a classic. Like, it's like, especially for Cold War movies that really could ham it up. I mean, there are so many during this period, from, like I said, Red Dawn to Rocky. Everybody was doing their Soviets tale. This one, It walks a line. It gets a little ham-fisted at points, but I think it's pretty good. I'm going to say, out of the movies we've seen, this is higher than Close Encounters, but below Jaws.
That's where I would put it as well.
That's exactly what I would say.
Yeah. It's in the middle.
Yeah, I was going to say, Brad, now that you've seen it, like how did you come away from it? Do you feel like it earned sort of like the, you know, the place in your mind of like, I need to see this? Like,
totally,
was it worth it?
I absolutely get why. I mean, it's, you know, it is a very taut, well put together, tense thriller kind of thing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, again, I didn't think it wrapped up maybe a little more tidily than I expected. Like, I thought the poetic ending would be, you know, like, despite all of his efforts, like the combined might of, you know, the Soviet military and intention would be just be too much, you know, and he would go down for noble causes kind of thing. But it was super fun to watch overall. Also, I have to mention real quick, Drew who mentioned that Alec Baldwin kind of looks like a ghost in that last scene in one spot.
Yeah.
I've got it in front of me right now. He's quite literally transparent.
Yeah.
you can actually see the tree line through his head. And yeah. I don't know what was going on there. I don't know if that's intentional.
Something
or not.
About the compositing was maybe slightly off there.
Also a shout out to the set constructors. Have you guys seen a shot of the subset?
No, I read about it. Okay. I read the Connery quote about how it was like they were like 45 feet above the floor of the stage.
And it tilts.
Yeah.
Check this out.
Gimbal.
Yeah. Drew's showing a picture.
Drew's showing it to us. Yeah, so this thing like rotates on like a 45-degree angle in either direction.
Oh, wow. They did this guys. For Star Trek.
Also, that interview stuff on the Blu-ray I mentioned, like, as cramped as it looks in the shots in the actual movie, they have footage of on set while they're shooting, and like, imagine all those officers crammed in there and an entire film crew crammed into those tiny little bridge or whatever. It's like, it is absolutely packed to the gills with people in there.
That's cinema, baby.
Also a movie that I think does not change with cell phones as we go through these movies. If you were to make it today, I think virtually zero changes with, you know, Drew, as we've been watching these, it's interesting to think like, oh, this would all be avoided if somebody just had a cell phone and you could just call. This one, no, because they're all underwater the entire time.
Yeah.
I think I can admit this. A giant bomb user invited me aboard a nuclear submarine a number of years ago. And when I got there, I had to put my cell phone in a metal box.
Oh, wow.
Before going on board.
Like no pictures or for interference?
No communication of any kind. Like, oh, wow. And the box stayed off the submarine.
Right, right.
So thank you. I'm sorry, I don't remember your name. But
this is why we brought you on the show, man. You've been there. You've seen this stuff up close.
Yeah, that's awesome.
That was very cool.
I think it's awesome. It sounds cool.
It's very tight, very cramped.
Right?
Yeah. Very. He I believe he worked in the kitchen. And I've been told, you know those cooks.
Mm-hmm.
I've been told that food aboard submarines is the best in the military.
Huh.
Because like you gotta have something to look forward to when you're cooped up down there. But he opened the pantry, and it was it was very narrow width wise, but very deep, and so you had to pack it so that you could only access, you know, a week at a time. So you had to kind of pack it with that in mind. And then right next door was a door with a big radiation symbol on it.
I was going to ask if you got to see the reactor. I'm guessing no, but...
No. Okay. But there were a lot of...
Yeah, that's one of those things they don't show
all
people.
Over. Yeah.
I don't think I could do it. I think I could go on a sub for a bit, and then at some point it would hit me that we're underwater in this thing, and there's no way out, and then I would freak out and never be able to not be thinking about that constantly. I think I could hang out and be like, this is cool, and then as soon as I have that realization that like we're in this pressurized thing, I would never be able to get out of my mind.
There's a World War II era submarine. Actually, the very submarine that was featured in the submarine film Down Periscope is docked in San Francisco, another one of my favorites. The USS Pampanito.
Oh, yeah, I've been to the Pampanito.
And you can tour it for like $20. It's great. And if you're a Boy Scout, they let you sleep on it. Which I did with my Boy Scout troop when I was a kid. And one of the chaperones could not handle it and had to sleep on the deck.
I mean, I get it. We also did a Boy Scout trip over here. We've got one by the Intrepid where you can go on an old submarine. But I think you sleep on, I don't think you sleep on the sub. I mostly remember it smelling like that waterproof paint,
And going on board, I toured it a few years ago. It smells exactly the same. It's like diesel fuel and oil.
It's enamel, that thick everything is coated in that like thick enamel paint. I guess you don't want any moisture rusting anything down there.
Yeah.
Red October. Hell of a movie. Yeah, hell of a movie.
Yeah.
Well, we got through most of the things I was going to throw out during rapid fire question time, but I do have one last one here, just real quick. And it's just an actor identifying question. Do any of you recognize the guy who was the talkie guy on the mini sub that they used to go over to the Red October? The guy who like shines the light on the boat is like, look at the size of that sucker. Hey, I think they're shooting a torpedo at us.
Is he the one that they slam the door on at the end? Yes. He's like, hey, where am
I supposed to go?
Yeah. Get the hell out of here.
I did not.
Do you recognize that actor from anything?
No.
Without looking it up.
I'm just trying to find out what he looks like, but oh, there he is. No.
Okay.
Oh, I'm looking, wait. Oh, that's the guy that I thought was Emilio Estevez at first.
Okay.
For a second.
That's the first time I ever heard that one. I always thought more Barry Boswick, but this is Timothy Carhart, who is, if you've ever watched Ghostbusters, he's the stiff.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
Huh. Oh, who's the stiff?
Yeah, the violinist that is hanging out with Sigourney Weaver.
Oh, that's funny. Okay. When was that? That's before this,
right?
That
was 84.
Okay.
That was like his second movie role.
That's funny.
Yeah. Anyway, that's all I had. Brad, you had something you wanted to say.
Oh, I was going to say, the last thing I can think of to say, I think, is I love the opening title of this movie. I love the Red October, but in Cyrillic, like, the kind of morphs at the end. Yeah, that whole thing is very good.
It's an incredible production. I think I'm in agreement with Vinny. It is a terrific movie. Maybe it doesn't quite top Jaws on the overall list, which we are definitely keeping, or someone probably is. But still a hell of a film all around, and I still think the best Clancy adaptation overall movie by far.
Hmm. Yes.
Well, now that we have done it, now that Brad has seen The Red October, we're not done yet when it comes to submarines. In 2 weeks, we will be watching the 1995 Tony Scott thriller, Denzel Washington, Gene Hackman, at their finest, in Crimson Tide, a movie that is very much about stuff that the U.S. Navy would rather not see portrayed. in a major motion picture. Brad, have you seen this one?
No.
Vinny, have you seen this one?
I did. I remember bits and pieces of it. I remember a very tense exchange with Denzel Washington and Gene Hackman. I remember some of that stuff. I remember it being tense. I mean, they are two very tense actors who can do staring contests very well.
This one excises a lot of the political stuff from Hunter October and just goes for the white knuckle tension pretty much the whole way through. Drew, you've seen this one, right?
I have, although not nearly as many times as Hunt for Red October. So it's been a while.
Well, would you like to join us again when we do it in a couple of weeks?
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
I do recommend looking up the movie poster for Hunt for Red October and the movie poster for Crimson Tide and then squinting and see if you could tell the difference, because
it's different actors and not much else.
Oh, wow. It really is the exact same treatment, isn't it? Jeez.
If you're going to make a submarine movie, the template's out there. Just plug it in.
Well, we will be roll-tiding in a couple of weeks, but next week we will be returning again to our Star Trek rewatch. We will be on to episodes 5 and 6, and those episodes are The Enemy Within and Mud's Women. So those are the episodes we will be watching for next week's show. Drew, thank you so much for joining us this week. I'm looking forward to having you back in a couple of weeks.
Yes, thanks for having me discuss one of my favorite topics.
Fantastic. Brad and Vinny, thank you as always.
Thank you.
And we will see you next time on the Next Lander Watchcast.